1.
The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up, and take it away. Take it away.
You know, that intro is very obnoxious and ridiculous, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I can't believe it. The Absolutely. Stream is like 2 minutes behind right now.
Is it really?
How yeah. unprofessional.
Very unprofessional.
Whoa, I just, all of a sudden, I had an increase in microphone volume. Perhaps my headphone cord was screwy, too.
Welcome to episode 143, 667.
667.
It's so ridiculous, man, that stuff.
You know.
But isn't it like 676?
Yeah, even as a Christian. Right.
I think you're right, like next year.
I think you're right.
Even as a Christian, I thought it was kind of stupid and ridiculous.
Really stupid and ridiculous.
Could you remember, what was it, last episode or the one before that, where I said that I went and watched, what was it, the, what was that movie? Help me out here.
Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code. Yeah, I went and saw the Da Vinci Code.
You're going to hell!
They said they had Christians outside the place protesting and stuff like that. I didn't see the problem, you know? I didn't see the problem with yesterday either. Nothing bad happened yesterday except for I got up and went to work.
Pat put out his Satan podcast.
Yes, Satan's podcast.
The Omen.
From the fifth level of the fifth hell.
Unfortunately, when it hit the server, it burned it up.
Yeah. That's what happens when you dabble with the infernal forces of damnation.
I don't get what the big deal was anyway, because, like, literally it says that the number is the number of man, which is 666, and, like, yesterday was 06-06-2006. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we were.
There's a slight difference in a number there.
Yeah, there was a few numbers off. I mean, microphones
and
dropping.
Of course, that depends on, you know, what country you're in, because it could be 2006-06-06.
This is true.
Something like that. I don't know. But anyway, you know, it was just dumb.
The microphone keeps dropping.
All these people talking about, you know, how they want to have abortions on the day before or something like that. Abortions, I mean, they want to have a...
They want their kid to have come on day before and not on 6-6.
Yeah. I read one story where this couple had a baby and they named him Damien. I thought that was kind of cool.
Damien?
Yeah, he was born on June 6th.
I like that popular movie. That email we got from Gary about proof that Gen 2 is evil.
Oh, yeah.
The rank of distribution rank.
Oh, yeah.
And
distribution
HPD
rank of 666.
Off of Distro Watch was 666. It's just fun. We got to post that on a blog or something.
So we had all sorts of wonderful reaction to our interview with Mark Chertoweth last week.
And most of it all was good.
For the most part, yeah.
Except for those.
And we got an interview coming out of it.
Except for those couple nagging armchair experts.
Yes, they want us to do a newscast.
Who just,
now for the news.
Just won't shut the hell up, you know?
We got an interview out of it coming up.
Do your own.
Yes, we do.
Show.
Exciting.
Pamela Jones from Grocklaw is going to be coming on.
And I know why we got a lot of hate mail, because right out of the bat, the vulgarity on that of last week's show was like...
F-bombs right out of the bat.
And it was all Alan's fault.
That's
he
it.
Really? He control his tongue.
Actually, I was the one who started it all.
I was going to say, I don't think I F-bombed it last week, did I?
I think I did one.
I think I did
we
one.
We all did them, like, within, like, 10 seconds of each other.
But it doesn't matter, because according to all the hate mail, nobody listens to our playful banter section of the podcast. Podcast, anyway.
Well, we do a good podcast, even though, well, you know, people think otherwise. We enjoy doing the podcast.
Oh, well, what are you going to
do? Nonetheless, we move on.
Yep.
And here's a request. You know,
as horrible as we are, here we are again this week to do it. So... such is life.
And Dan's back, as you can hear in the background.
Perfuming the air.
Oh.
Yeah, thank God the fan is blowing out this week, so it's like you'll get most of it, Pat.
So, Dan, I see a new Crapple product on your desk there.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. I just wanted to make some more comments.
I don't want to hear any freaking comments.
Last week in Virginia.
40s by the car, literally.
Yeah.
You hear the bottles clanking in the background.
The whole week, the whole time I was down there, I had no problems, absolutely no problems using Ubuntu as the main operating system on my PowerBook, you know, connecting with the airport. No, it wasn't a wireless, but just connecting through the hotel for the free internet connection. Not a problem at all using it, running updates. It was really great. The only problem I had was in the airports when I went to connect wirelessly. See, the thing that really throws you is you go down here to ABE, International Airport, and it's free Wi-Fi, which is great.
Sweet.
Ooh. And you can go right up here to the Holiday Inn up there.
Yeah, but I wasn't flying out of the Holiday Inn, okay?
Okay.
I was flying out of ABE. But you
were looking for free access.
Yeah, but
so you got internet access from across the highway.
Across the highway, yeah. But we go down to Philadelphia, and it's not free.
You have to pay for stuff.
Newark Airport in Virginia, not Newark, Newport, I think it's Newport, not free either. But you can connect, which throws you. Because I connected with the Airport Extreme through Ubuntu, and I'm like, how come I have an IP address? And I can ping my server at home, but I can't SSH, I can't. You know, browse the web or anything. Because when you bring it up, they require you to authenticate and log in for a paid service. It's like $11 for that 15 minutes I was supposed to be in the airport. But it was cool that I had absolutely no problem.
That's a great airport. There's like 10 people in the whole place.
Right, ABE.
Yeah,
it is. There's like nobody.
I flew out of there once.
We had to take a prop plane, though.
Puddle jumper.
They're fun, yeah. Puddle jumpers are awesome.
Yeah.
Anybody from here to where, Philly?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody puke?
No, not at all. Fun. It's like, as soon as you get up and they turn the seatbelt light off, you got like a minute
they
two.
Turn
and
it right
they
back
turn
it on.
And you go back go down.
For
the
it's like riding a roller coaster for an hour.
Yeah. An hour. It was like 15
minutes.
Like 15, 20 minutes.
Well, I went on one. I took a puddle jumper from South Dakota to Denver, and it was about an hour flight or so. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that sucked is flying back, our plane was delayed. They had to delay us because of the amount of traffic in the air. So we were delayed, and that pushed up. We were supposed to make a connecting flight in Philadelphia. At like we had to be there by 7:50. We didn't get into like 7:30, 20 of. And the plane was in the terminal on the other side. You know, all the way on the other side. About as far away as you can get. So we had to hot foot it over there, and we get over there, and the plane there is delayed because the pilots who were going to fly that plane back to AB were flying in from Ithaca, didn't arrive till after 9 o'clock. So we board the plane
it's
at
good
9 o'clock.
Reason to delay.
A thunderstorm starts somewhere within five miles of the airport, so they have to close the ramp. Planes can go in and out, but they have to close the ramp. And that means everybody off the ramp, they can't load the plane up. So they had, like, luggage, a few bags of luggage that they had to load. But they closed the ramp and left the luggage sitting out there in the rain.
Oh, great.
So we sat on the plane for about a half an hour. Then they opened the ramp. The workers took too long to get out there. So by the time they got out there, they closed the ramp again. So they had to wait another half an hour until it cleared up. Then the stewardess. Is it a stewardess? Yeah. Flight attendant.
Flight attendant. Yeah, this is
not called stewardess.
It's not 70s anymore.
The flight attendant jumped out of the plane and loaded those last few bags so we could get the heck out of there. So we were delayed about an hour and a half.
This chick jumped out of the plane.
She did.
20 feet in the freaking air.
No, it was a prop plane, man.
She had wearing like the old 70s stewardess uniform with
the
flying gun headset and shit.
Yeah, the 4 steps to the ground.
No!
Yeah, you don't get that tunnel thing.
A little parachute jump out there. Throw the bags in. She must have been in. Get them. I'll tell you what.
We did the puddle jumper going up to Vermont one time. That was a great... I love riding those things.
She must be from Austria.
Unless you got somebody sitting next to you who's puking up their guts into a paper bag, then it's not so fun.
No, luckily, unless you got Pat trying to reach the Mile High Club all the time. Yeah.
Luckily, it was a coworker, and she wasn't getting sick, so.
Ooh.
It was a group of us that went up. Sorry. Oh. Although we did get kicked out of the hotel bar. So.
Did they say, gentlemen and lady, would you please leave?
Basically, yeah.
It wasn't quite that polite, right?
It was four of us. It was like, you can't have any more to drink.
Did you do the mash?
No.
The monster mash?
No.
Oh, so Pat, you're excited for me to talk about this MacBook.
Superior Woo-hoo! Apple product.
Yeah. So
Pat, don't scream into your mic. I watched all the lights go red when you said that.
Superior Apple product.
Well, you can scream. Just scream farther away from the mic.
A superior Apple product.
There you go.
Okay. Apple is excited and was really thrilled to send me a demo copy or demo, a test version. Not test version. What am I looking for?
A demo machine.
A demo machine. Okay, we'll call it a demo machine of the MacBook because, you know, it's such a great piece of technology. And they sent me one to try on 30 days for work.
Uh-huh.
And because they know that we're looking, obviously, to buy laptops in the very near future, like in the next couple of months. And, of course, Apple wants to make a few bucks, and can't begrudge them for wanting to do that. So they sent me the MacBook, and I will admit, it's probably about the nicest laptop I've ever used. Ergonomically, it's really nice. The keys are sweet. The tactile feel of the keyboard is nice.
Square chiclets there.
Yeah, it is really nice. My only two complaints about this, of course, is I don't like the magnetic case closing anymore. You know, the old ones used to have the little latch that you push in and lift up. This has like a magnetic thing, so when you close it, it snaps shut, and then you got to kind of almost use two hands a little bit because it's the magnet in there. The display is beautiful. It's got a, and I'll pass it around in just a minute. But the display is really pretty.
And I'll take it home.
Yeah.
Not if I get it first.
And it has a little eyesight built into the top of it, which I don't know if it works on anything but OS X, but when you first start the thing up, it says, you know, it allows you to take a little picture of yourself for your login picture. And, you know, this little things like that are nice. My other complaint, of course, is the mouse only has one button, which makes it really annoying. I absolutely hate the one button mouse. And I'm glad that the trackpad itself isn't...
You can, like, double-click with that, can't you?
No, not that you can't. Not with this trackpad.
Oh, really?
It won't let you do it. No, it won't.
You have to pay extra for the software, right?
I don't know. I don't know if that's disabled or what, but I can't do it on my PowerBook either, and I'm glad because I hate that. Because I hate when I'm trying to do something with the trackpad.
It was only on the
and
new
it keeps
ones.
Clicking things, but this one does not have it.
Okay,
this one you can't. Maybe it's disabled.
Or maybe it was two fingers.
That's why I have a ThinkPad so that I get the nipple to play with.
There you go. The OS X. You know, it's OS X. What I didn't like about when you first started up and after you boot up the first time, it keeps pestering you as if you want to sign up for a .Mac account.
Mm-hmm.
Like you tell it, no, I don't. Then you get another screen and it's like, get 60 days for free.
No,
I don't want it. Well, just let us. Are you sure you don't want it? Yeah.
But if you do, you'll have access to this and this and this.
Yeah, so what we were really impressed with was how fast this thing is. It was blazing. We fired up OpenOffice, and it came up in under 5 seconds. You know, on the PPC version of the GIMP, sometimes you have a problem with when you try and load it in. It does something with the fonts or something, whatever. It causes a delay in the login. I mean, at the login, the startup of the application. Sometimes that delay is like a significant 2 or 3 minutes, which is really odd. GIMP came up here in under 5 seconds.
So what are you trying
Not
to
bad.
Say? Uncle Steve was lying when he said PPC was better?
Well, hold on, I'm getting there. And this thing was, like, was beautiful. I mean, we couldn't believe how fast it was. So we actually look at the specs on this thing. Probably the reason why it's really fast is because it's running 2 gigs of RAM.
And it'll help.
And it has a 100 gig hard drive. Now, if you go out and buy yourself a MacBook, you have three flavors that you can buy. You can buy the low-end one for, like, what is it, $1,000? Then there's the mid-range one for $1,200 or $1,300. And then the upper-range one, which is, what, 10 more gigs on the hard drive and a black case.
And black,
and that's, like, $1,500 or $1,600. Well, we spec the price this one would actually cost, which is a mid-range one. And with the RAM upgrade and the upgrade of the hard drive that they put in here, if it was a 100 gig hard drive, it would run over $2,000.
It's a bargain.
Yeah, so.
What the bargain for me?
Well, I find
who
it.
Who in the right
I
mind would pay $500
really,
for five, or a gig of RAM that they want to charge?
Yeah, I find it a really great. It's really sweet system. I wish they would have sent me a standard instead of beefing it up. And giving me the illusion that, you know, the standard one, if
so
I hadn't checked.
Tell them that, can't you? Tell
take,
them
I will, take a I stick say, of RAM out of it.
Send it back and say, you know, listen, can you
send me the money?
Send me the low-end one right out of the box.
So you may have to, like, grab 2 500 meg sticks.
Okay, you give me 2 500 megs, that'll work.
Well, I'm saying, but, you know.
But anyway, it would have been, you know, nice to give me something that was just... Because now if we went and we based upon this and we purchased them, we'd be in kind of for a rude surprise.
Right, because you'd get 20 laptops
like
and you'd power them up and they'd still be trying to load open Office.
Right? Yeah, it wouldn't be as snappy.
But no, actually, yeah, and that's a Core Duo, right?
Yes, it is.
Now, I got the... you guys all know that I have the Intel Mac Mini, and I got the single core Intel Mac Mini with... 512 megs of RAM, and you know, just the basic standard $600 version, which is still a lot of money, but it's a nice little box. That actually will do OpenOffice pretty well itself. And you know, I don't have a whole lot of problems doing anything. I think the addition of another 512 megs of RAM on my single core Mac Mini will make a world of difference, but it really runs nice and fast now. And I have heard that the low end Mac laptops, the new Intel Mac laptops, MacBooks, run just as well. So,
and cool. To bring it right
back
around,
I'm sure
around,
it's really nice having 2 gigs of RAM and stuff like that.
Oh yeah,
I think it'll run just fine.
You can buy a whole new laptop for the price of a gig of RAM.
Yeah,
512 megs of RAM.
But to bring it back around to Linux, of course, what I really, really was interested in primarily was running a version of Linux on this Intel MacBook.
Mm-hmm.
And for work, I also needed to test whether, you know, how Windows would run on here or install. So to start off with, I figured I'd go.
You mean you got your school district would buy those computers and put Windows on them?
I would think they would.
Probably.
Yeah. So I decided to go down the boot camp route and try out boot camp. And I threw boot camp on here, and it does a repartitioning of the hard drive right there for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a Windows drivers disk so that you can load Windows on here. And what I did was I did that, and I created myself a 30-gig partition so that I was going to split that between Windows and Linux.
Right.
So when I booted up the Windows install through the boot camp, I chose to repartition again and split that free space into 15 gigs and 15 gigs for Windows and Linux. And I went and I installed Windows, went through the file copy process, and when it rebooted, it came up with, it said it couldn't find the hal.dll was missing. So I was out looking on the web, and I saw only really one really well-reported version of this problem, and the guy said he just kept reinstalling. He did it 3 times until it finally took. So after my third go-around with this, I saw another posting on, you know, for a, not boot camp specific, but said usually you could boot into recovery mode on the disk and just copy that file over there or extract it into there, and nothing would work. It said usually you have a bad disk. So I tried another disk from an MSDN subscription, which had like 3 different versions on there, and it comes up with a boot menu when you put it in there, and it says choose A, B, or C for what version of Windows you want. So, and I couldn't even get past that point. It would not allow me to have any input for some reason. So I'm like, and what's the most annoying thing is when you boot off of a Windows XP install CD, it takes like 3 or 4 minutes just to get up into a point where you can start begin to do the install.
But that's normal on any machine.
Oh no, I know.
I've done six XP installs in the last 3 days. That's normal on any machine. It's not a MacBook.
No, I know it's not. But it's just such a long way. Well, anyway, I figured at this point, it's not. I'm wasting my time here. So I pulled down Ubuntu, Dapper Drake, burned it to a disk, and slapped it in there. And right off the bat, sweet, sweet. I mean, that's pretty nice. Live distribution install.
Mm-hmm.
I bring it up. You got the working desktop. I go to do the install.
Nice install.
I run the partitioner, and it doesn't like the partitions on there for some reason. So whatever Bootcamp does, it kind of like makes screwy partition tables for the system,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't really like it. So I tried. Hello, how you doing today?
Pretty good.
I just want to let you know you're live right now.
So
okay. And you know what? I'll finish my MacBook story afterwards. But we have a great guest tonight. Pat, why don't you introduce our guest?
We've got Joe Zonker-Brockmeyer, the editorial director of Linux.com. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks a lot.
How do we sound to you? Do we sound okay?
I'm sorry?
How do we sound to you?
Pat was just asking, is the sound okay for you? Can you hear us?
I can hear you, but I couldn't hear him very clearly.
Yeah, nobody can.
it always works out that way.
Yeah, for some reason, nobody could ever hear him.
Okay.
So how you doing tonight? Everything everything going well for you today?
Yeah, going great. I just finished a Ubuntu review today that I've been working on for a couple days, and glad to get that off of my plate.
Yeah, that's the big thing in the past week, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the kind of the generating the most excitement right now. You know, I know a lot of people were waiting for the release. A lot of people didn't wait for the release and just have been running the unstable or the development versions for a while now. But I know a lot of people on the user list were real excited when it finally came out.
And then, of course, it takes almost a week to just be able to do the downloads because everybody's hammering the site so bad, you know?
Actually, the torrents were really quick. What's taken so long is I tried to cover each of the... tried to cover Ubuntu, Kubuntu, and Xubuntu. And so, I mean, there's just so much stuff there. And, of course, you miss somebody's pet feature and you get flamed as soon as you put the review up. Well, how in the world could you miss this, you know?
Did you do the server stuff? The server, like the new LAMP server install?
Actually, that's going to be a separate review. Because
oh, man, how could
so
you miss that? I've been waiting all...
Exactly.
But, no, it's good that you're doing that. And what kind of wonderful things can you tell us about, you know, Linux.com? Tell us on Linux.com.
Okay. Basically, I hope most of your listeners are already familiar with Linux.com, but Linux.com is part of OSTG, which is kind of a subset of VA software. We're basically in the publishing arm of the company. Linux.com, and I also work with NewsForge. We basically try to cover news about open source and Linux. We try not to limit just to Linux. We try to cover BSDs and, you know, important software like Firefox and, you know, GIMP and OpenOffice and all the things that make Linux good and make, you know, even Windows, if you're still on Windows, make Windows bearable, you know. So we try to cover the whole gamut, and we also try to do breaking news, and we try to talk to people who are important in the community. And there's quite a bit to cover in the open source and Linux arena.
Now, how long have you guys been doing that?
Linux.com, I was not actually part of the original crew, but VA Software bought the domain, I think it was in 2000. So they've been doing that for quite a while. NewsForge was originally part of Andover, and they bought that and added it. And, of course, OSTG also encompasses Fresh Meat and encompasses Slashdot, of course. So, I mean, we've got quite a wide range of sites, you know. But I've been with the site since August of last year.
Now, Joe, you've written quite a bit of articles over the years for different publications, Linux-related, right?
Yeah, I've written for... I started off writing for Linux Magazine in 99, right, like about their third issue. And then I've written for Linux Weekly News quite a bit and Unix Review and a couple other websites and other publications as well, some of which unfortunately didn't quite make it through the dot-com bubble bursting. But, yeah, I've been probably written a few thousand articles by now.
So over your career of writing for Linux, obviously you've seen a positive trend in the adoption of Linux over time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
it's actually been pretty... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, it's actually been pretty... I mean, it's been pretty impressive when you consider what... a fairly active community and a few companies have managed to do in less than, you know, I mean, Linux has been around since 1991, but really, really took off about 1997, 98, when it started getting commercial support and, or more commercial support and more attention from people and became, you know, people started realizing, hey, this stuff is actually good enough to use in production environments and, you know, good enough to run websites and servers. And it really took off in that time frame. And, the you know, what it's managed, or what the community has managed to accomplish on the server side and on the desktop is phenomenal.
So then, speaking of the desktop, that's kind of where Linux has been poised to really make a big impact for the past couple of years now. And we really have yet to see it. You seeing, you know, maybe it'll never make that dent, or do you see that as being still 5 or 6 years off?
I don't know that it will ever make as huge of a dent as it has on the server. I hope it does. But I think over the next couple of years, particularly as Vista comes out, and if it's as bad as I expect it will be, I think the companies will start looking at options. And I think that both Ubuntu and SUSE or Novell are both in really good positions to capitalize on business deployments of Linux in particular, where you don't have quite as many programs that need to exist to make somebody happy in an office desktop environment, in a, you know, in a work environment or a call center. And when people start using it in work environments more, and they get comfortable with it there, I think you'll see a lot more home adoption as well. And I only think it needs to crack about a 10 to 20% share of the market before it starts really getting the crucial hardware and vendor support that it needs to be viable in the home market.
And that right there, I mean, the hardware support, the technical issues behind Linux are just a matter of numbers and, you know, because... The technical prowess of the community can easily surmount those obstacles, and it would make it a whole lot easier to get the vendor support. But the flip side to that, the non-technical hurdles, like the legal issues, the patent issues, seem to be a bigger challenge for Linux adoption on the desktop.
Right now, I think the patent issues are more... you know, I think a lot of people were predicting patent problems about this time. I know Bruce Perens, for example, has been talking about it for years, and other people have been talking about patents. But patents have mainly been an impediment just in a chilling factor sense. People not wanting to implement things because they're afraid of patents, not because somebody's been suing. It's not in Microsoft's best interest, I don't think, to sue for patents, on patents, because there are so many companies deeply involved with Linux that could counter-sue Microsoft that it would be unproductive. And I think maybe even Microsoft is starting to get a whiff or are starting to understand that software patents aren't a really good idea since they've been getting hit right and left with software patent suits that they've been losing. You know, maybe they might finally understand what a crapshoot it is to deal with software patents and put some muscle behind getting rid of them. I hope, but I can't guarantee that would happen. So the legal issues, I think, are more of a chilling factor than a real threat at this point.
The legal issues. And what do you mean specifically by that?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, things like worrying about implementing certain things because there are patents, there are known to be patents in those areas. And there's also a lot of good work being done by, like, the Software Freedom Law Center and OSDL and other, you know, Red Hat and some other companies putting together patent protection umbrellas for Linux and open source software.
And that goes along with the multimedia codecs and stuff like that, DRM-related issues.
Yeah. Yeah, to some extent. And multimedia, I mean, that too has been taken care of to an extent. I mean, you have companies like Linspire and Novell, which will ship, you know, supported multimedia. You know, they'll pay for licenses for the people who are buying the box sets. And, in fact, in the case of Linspire, they're even going to start giving away a free version of Linspire with most multimedia codecs enabled, and they're picking up the tab for that. And they're still making it free as in beer.
And that's be something that could be used on non-Linspire or FreeSpire distributions. Like you could use it under Debian, under Fedora, or whatever.
They haven't released the distribution, but that was my sense, that you would be able to use those packages elsewhere. So, I mean, there's really fewer impediments in that area than there used to be. And maybe, you know, maybe we'll get lucky and there will be some progress and support for non-patent-encumbered codecs like Ogg Vorbis and so forth. I know that the Ubuntu release, they tried and they shipped some multimedia stuff with the distribution just to demonstrate that, you know, you can listen to sound and video and watch video on Linux without it being encumbered by patent or being a non-free format.
Right. It would be nice if we can see adoption of Ogg or Theora and Xvid and all those other, you know, those wonderful codecs. But, you know, it's, I don't know. I made a comment to Mark Shuttleworth. It doesn't seem like, you know, the Apples or the Microsofts are willing to throw that support into their operating system, because that's where I can see the real barrier being. If they don't adopt it, it makes it difficult for content providers to even consider using the open codecs as an option for their content.
You know what, and this might be a little off color, but you know what would really help drive adoption of Ogg Vorbis and free formats is, one, get companies like YouTube to use them and, you know, to deploy content that people want to watch. And two, if they started releasing porn in those formats, I mean, we all know that's one of the things that drives adoption on the computer. You know, if people could only see their porn if they came in a certain format, they'd adopt the format pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, you're right there. That is the market to hit. You know,
now, wait a minute. Only Dan and Pat can pick somebody to come on the show and give an interview that goes in the first 15 minutes to porn.
Oh, don't be a
I just have to.
and we're very proud of that.
And we're very proud of that, right? Well, good. At least
Bobby,
we have,
what's this new program on the computer for? homework.
At least we have a guest with a good sense of humor.
But, you know, I guess, you know, that would be a good, if you went to a porn site, instead of a pop-up window and installing spyware, they just install the Theora codecs for your player. They drop it down there. Hey, you know, that would be rapid adoption.
Maybe there's something to that. You guys should, like, do some investigation, you know.
Yeah, there we go. We can start a new company.
Dan's going to give Vivid a call.
Vorbis Porn or something like that. I don't know.
Well, and you guys are helping by offering the, you know, offering the streams or whatever in OGG, in OGG format.
Yeah,
you
we
know, making it possible.
We do. We originally didn't start with the MP3. I mean, with OGG support because of bandwidth issues and not having a. You know, we did eventually come around to seeing the error of our ways, and we really prefer the OGG format. People use that, but unfortunately, our download statistics show that you know, people out there
4-1 MP3s.
And you know what? And I think that goes hand in hand with the fact that the majority of our downloads come through iTunes, and iTunes does not support. I don't think you can get OGG. Well, you know what? You can't. The way we got OGG,
I think you
OGG
can. You
feed,
can subscribe to an OGG podcast. You can't listen to it by default under iTunes.
You know what? I don't even know you can do that, because I know we got our streams. Mm-hmm. Well, when Adam Curry posted it, we didn't have the OGG format, did we?
I don't think so.
But I've tried to submit an RSS feed for Apple iTunes that had OGG format in it, and they would not accept it at all. They accepted the MP3, but they would not accept the OGG format.
Bad form. Bad form.
So,
but now we even do a little bit extra with our high quality OGG file, just as an incentive.
No, we do it with both OGGs.
With
have
both
all the
OGGs.
Content.
Extra
yeah.
content.
And both OGGs. All right, well, both of our OGGs, we have a little extra content to try and persuade people to download the OGG format and get that going a little bit better.
Yeah, and all our videos that we put out are under Theora.
Right?
All like five of them. No, we're getting so far off the... sorry about that there. Patting ourselves on the back. Our porno will all be in Theora format. Now, where were we? We were talking about Linux adoption on the desktop. And another issue, what I would like to see a lot more of, and we see it with the garage gaming developers and the underground gaming developers, is a gaming support under Linux. That would be nice.
Yeah, and there really isn't a lot going on in gaming on Linux. I mean, most of the action, I think, is with you know, companies trying to port Windows games to Linux, and that's going to be... That really is it's a tough nut to crack, because it costs a lot of money to develop the kind of games that people want to buy and want to play. And, you know, id Software, I've got to give them props, because they've been porting Quake and Doom and so forth to Linux for many, many years, or at least letting other companies do it. And, you know, a couple other companies have been nice enough to put development efforts into having their games ported to Linux, like Unreal Tournament and so forth. But, yeah, there really is a big gap there. And I don't really know how to solve that one. If I did, I might be a lot wealthier than I am now, which isn't very.
There you go. And, you had mentioned, you brought up FreeSpire, and you mentioned SUSE, and what's nice is some of the stuff that SUSE is coming out with, and now the name of it eludes me, but the SUSE Forge or whatever it is, where people will be able to upload source code and it'll automatically create a SUSE package. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I've actually talked to a couple of their folks about that, and they're still, I think, fleshing out all the details, but it's a really exciting idea. Basically letting people not only generate packages for Novell and SUSE products, but also develop packages for like Red Hat or Ubuntu or Debian or whatever whatever you want, is huge, because, you know, there are so many projects that you can really only find packages for on the developer's pet distribution. You know, if they're a big fan of Fedora, then you'll get it on Fedora, but if you're on Mandriva, you're pretty much hosed. And of course, just because distributions share a format like RPM or Debian packages doesn't mean that the packages carry over from one to another, which is unfortunate. But so yeah, that's some exciting stuff. I can't remember what they were calling it either, but it's... you notice that Red Hat and Ubuntu and all the major commercial players, Novell, are really getting into the idea that they need to cooperate with one another to make this successful. They're not going after the same piece of the pie. They're going after Microsoft's market share, not the other guy's Linux market share.
Hey, 'cause that's one thing that started to concern me for a little bit there is if you would go out and look at software, and particularly commercial software, I was starting to see a lot of it kind of centered on Red Hat or RPM-based distributions, which made it difficult to install them on Debian-style distributions. And then, with the popularity of Ubuntu, you start seeing Ubuntu packages as opposed to some of the RPMs. And being able to install, the software that you want to use on whatever flavor of Linux you wanted to use was starting to look like it may be a little more difficult than you'd want it to be.
Yeah, and it's still not easy necessarily, but it's definitely gotten a lot easier. And Click, I think it is, and there's another format that also, for desktop users, shows a lot of promise in terms of being kind of multi-platform. Basically, it doesn't matter if you're on a Debian-based or an RPM-based system. You just download a Click package or something like that, and away you go, which is what a lot of users who are coming from Windows or the Mac are used to anyway.
So what's your opinion on that type of click and run service? Click or, now we just recently had Google release Picasa for Linux, and, it's almost on the same caliber right there. You have an application which could be a lot smaller than the actual file is to run it. Like a Click service or the Google Picasa, because it contains like all the Wine libraries, or with Click it contains all the necessary static libraries to run that application, instead of getting a native package for your distribution, which would be a lot slimmer. You're seeing a little more bloat. Does that concern you?
Not a great deal, because I think that, number one, it's not enough bloat. I mean, unless you're trying to use Linux on, say, a Pentium 2-300 or something like that, it's not enough that it's going to really, it's really going to affect most users. And if you really care about it, you can get packages in a native format or make them in a native format for the most part, with the exception of something like Picasa, which requires Wine. So, I mean, It doesn't really concern me a great deal. I mean, from a purist, if I were a BSD developer, I might be concerned about it. But what I mostly care about is getting people over to the free software desktop. And we can worry about the details, and we can worry about making it faster and better as we go along, rather than trying to do everything perfect the first time.
Amen to that.
So then, getting people over to the free desktop, one of the paths that has been proposed is releasing a lot of the really, great free software out there, like OpenOffice, Firefox, Scribus, Inkscape, all these wonderful applications on closed platforms like Windows and OS X, in hopes that, those people can enjoy the fruits of the open source and free software movement and maybe attract more people to adopt Linux. You think that's a good path?
Yeah, I do, because if you can get somebody familiar, if you can get them weaned off of Microsoft Office, and you can switch them to OpenOffice, and you can get them away from Internet Explorer and get them used to using Firefox, and you can get them convinced that free software can actually do what they want to do, then it's just a couple more steps to saying, I don't need Microsoft at all. I can just go to Linux and have all these packages I'm used to and not have to worry about the licensing fees or headaches for any of it. So I think it is a good idea. I mean, I understand there might be some users who say, well, I can get OpenOffice on Windows, so I'm not going to switch. I still think it's better to have OpenOffice available for those users than to not. But at least they're using some free software, rather than none.
It's also something that they're using that we know is compatible with the open source version of software.
Right. I mean, you might have a friend who's on Windows but you can still share, you know, a Word or a, you know, an open office document with them, and get things done. You know, if you're a student, for example, and you use Linux, but your, you know, college note-taking buddy happens to use Windows, at least you two can share notes or whatever via open office.
Sure.
More easily than you could. So,
sure, document portability and all that fun stuff that really needs to happen.
I'm sorry?
Said all that document portability and stuff that needs to happen.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think that's really fairly important. You know, as long as people have the option of moving, the thing I don't really care for about Microsoft and Microsoft Office is that you don't really have the option of switching. They don't want you to have the option of switching. For some people, Microsoft Office might be the greatest thing in the world, and I don't begrudge them using it, but I don't want to have to. And not because really so much of the licensing fee. I've just never cared for Office to begin with.
Mm-hmm. So then, at the popularity of the of something like OpenOffice, do you think that eventually that's going to put the needed pressure on Microsoft so that they will adopt the open document format, or do you think that, you know, they're just not going to ever do that?
I think someone already developed a plugin that lets Office support it to begin with. As far as Microsoft officially supporting it, it's going to take a huge market shift. Basically, Microsoft really only likes to support other formats when it means they can coax people away from competitors. Uh-huh. They don't like the idea of, you know, letting you leave them. So, going to take a lot.
And speaking of competing products and Office, in the past week we've seen a kind of a fallout between Adobe and Microsoft with regards to PDF support and Office products.
You know, I'm not really sure what to think of that. I mean, this is one of the few occasions where I look at Microsoft's position and I kind of think they're getting the short end of the stick on that one.
Isn't it great?
Well, but the thing is, it's bad for their users. Because, first of all, I don't really understand how Adobe convinced them to drop the support. It's something that, legitimately, I don't think it's an anti-competitive move on Microsoft's part to include PDF support. I think that's legitimately something their users really wanted. And so Microsoft was, you know, legitimately trying to give them something they wanted. Remember, Microsoft is trying to invent their own competitive format to PDF.
Right.
So it's actually against their best interest to support PDF, but they did it anyway. And then here comes Adobe saying, no, no, you can't do that. So, yeah, I think Microsoft is doing the right thing in that particular case.
Yeah, I kind of thought about it myself, and I said, well, wait a minute. Why are they flexing their muscle against Microsoft and not doing it against, you know, all the other projects out there incorporating it, you know, even OpenOffice? And that would suck if they did flex their muscle with regards to that. But
because Microsoft has a shitload of money.
Well, yeah, I know that. And the concern is that they'll take away the Adobe's PDF creation business.
Kind of biting the hand that feeds, basically.
Yeah.
So what happens if OpenOffice ends up grabbing a huge market share? Does that mean that they're going to come after the OpenOffice folks and tell them you can't do that anymore either?
Yeah, I know. That's one of the things I thought of, because they're like selecting right now. They're just selecting Microsoft, but, you know, what if?
You know, so, I mean, if that's the case, I think that you know, that's really a poor move on Adobe's part. Yes, it's part of their profit center, but they've made it so popular. They're a victim of their own success in a certain way. And I don't think that every single user that wants to share a PDF really needs to be paying a license fee to Adobe. And they've made the format, if I remember correctly, the PDF format specification allows you to implement readers and writers for it as long as you adhere to the specification. I think that's supposed to be the only major requirement.
Right.
I could be wrong on that, but
that's going to be a sticky issue for a little while there.
You know what I think is kind of a shame? Basically that so much time now is wasted on worrying about patents and legal issues and not the technology. Because the thing that really excites me about Linux is the technology and what people can do with open source and free software. Not, you know, having to worry about patent and legal maneuverings to be able to use my computer the way I want to. I mean, that's what attracted me to Linux in the first place was, you know, here's a community of people who are saying, we want to help you do what you want to do. Free of charge, just here's all this stuff, just use it and maybe give us some code back, you know. And now it's gotten to the point where everything you do in the tech industry is looking over your shoulder waiting for the lawyer pulse, you know.
Right. And, you know, there was a, I don't know which site posted it, but there was an article I read today. That, you know, that's becoming a big problem, and particularly in the United States, that, you know, if you take your software, if you're working on something and you don't patent it, you know, someone else is going to, which is going to make almost render it that you can't use the own project that you created, even if you're the author of it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the patent system is rigged in favor of large companies anyway. I mean, if I wrote a program that invented something, but I didn't patent it, and then somebody else, one of the patent clearinghouses that just sues people, manages to get a patent that seems to apply to what I've written, I don't have the money to defend a patent suit. So I basically pretty much have to fold or, you know, devote my life to fighting a patent suit rather than developing a program and doing my normal work. And, you know, I mean, that's true of even small companies. You know, they just don't have the funds to fight a patent suit, even when they're right.
Right, and that's...
it's pathetic.
It stinks. So
that's not a happy topic.
No, it's not. It's not. So let's talk about some happy topics. Talk about the Linux.com. What challenges do you face on a day-to-day basis with putting together a site like that, being an editor for the site like Linux.com?
Wow. Well, I won't get into the intricacies of just actually editing copy because that could probably be pretty dull. I do it every day, and I can assure you it is pretty dull. The big challenges are trying to make sure that we're actually interesting people with what we publish, and making sure that we do, you know, we publish something of quality, which is, you know, if you read the comments, you sometimes wonder if you're doing that. You just have to remember, I think, a lot of times that people are usually only motivated to comment when they're upset about something. You know, very few people take the time to leave a comment that says, I read this and it met my expectations, thank you. You know, you just get the people, and of course trolls, but you get people who, you know, well, you were, you know, not entirely correct here, or you didn't mention my favorite program here and I'm upset because, you know, whatever reason. So I think the biggest challenge is trying to figure out what it is our readers want to read and figuring out ways to bring in new readers every day and make them steady readers.
And I guess with regards to that, you got to have some thick skin there, because obviously you're not going to please everybody all the time.
No. You know, if in the publishing industry, if you don't have a thick skin, you don't belong in it, to be perfectly honest. I mean... you're especially in the tech industry, because geeks love to nitpick. I think it's just a natural response.
Yeah, we're a little familiar with that effect.
I'm sorry.
We're somewhat familiar with that.
Yeah, we have a we have an ongoing conversation with a few armchair experts of our own occasionally about our show. So we know exactly where you're coming from.
Well, and, you know, and everybody is entitled to their opinion. And one of the things that always amuses me is when someone, you know, leaves a message. I'll give you an example. A couple months ago, I wrote an article about Mepis Linux. And there are a couple folks who just have the opinion that because Robin Miller happens to be friends with the guy who publishes Mepis, that we were being too nice and we were giving them too much coverage, even though it was like the first article we had run on it in like 6 months. And, you know, it occurs to me, you know, did you ever think of just not clicking on the link to read the article? When you saw Mepis in the title, did it ever occur to you, just don't click that link?
You're asking for too much.
Yeah, well, I mean, I learned a long time ago. I used to work in radio, and I had to board jockey shows like, I happen to be a little bit on the liberal-leaning side, I will admit. And I used to have to board jockey shows like Rush Limbaugh and, you know, Focus on the Family. I don't like them. And I'm not saying that anyone else should or shouldn't like them, but I don't like them, so I don't listen to them. Problem solved. Mm-hmm. You know? If a show upsets you, don't listen to it. You know?
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes the feedback you do get, even if it's negative and critical, it can be valuable.
Right. The feedback you get that's negative and critical and non-constructive can be valuable, yeah.
Sometimes it is. I mean, sometimes, you know, a lot of the feedback, I don't want to discourage anybody from giving us feedback, by the way. A lot of the feedback we do get is valuable. Sometimes it may not be as, you know, diplomatically phrased as it could be, but it's certainly valuable. And, I mean, I usually go through, I don't often get into comment, I don't often leave comments on my own stories, but I usually do read the comments to my stories because I am interested. And I do want to know what people think, you know, and the trolls I just basically have learned to ignore. Because you have.
Yeah, that can be a tough thing.
Don't feed the trolls.
Sometimes you can't help it sometimes, though.
But they're important. They're part of your community. They make it interesting.
What is cool is, you know, you write a story and somebody comes in and says, you know, I refer to it, and, you know, I didn't coin this term, but I refer to it as a lazy web, you know, where you run up against a brick wall, you do a review of something like Ubuntu, and you find a problem, and somebody comes in the comments and, like, gives you 800 words on how they solved that problem. You know, it's like, oh, okay, great, you know, thanks very much. Because our audience collectively is a heck of a lot smarter than any of us are individually. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a lot of smart readers, and we learn probably more from them than they do from us. So I don't want to give the impression that all of the commenters are negative. Unfortunately, they're just the ones you remember more.
Right. How large is the Linux.com staff? I mean, how many people do you have maintaining this website and upkeep and everything?
Well, counting full-time and full-time editors, we have four or five people on staff full-time. We have several people who are more or less full-time contractors for reasons that are... For example, we don't employ people outside the United States as full-time employees. So we have some contractors. I would say it's about 10 people between NewsForge and Linux.com.
So now,
that's not counting the IT staff or anybody who has to, you know, worry about the back end or anything like that. That's just editorial.
So one of the questions I was going to ask you with regarding probably the back end and having a site where people can post comments and everything. What about content spam? Do you guys run into that kind of issue on your site like that, people trying to post spam?
We haven't had a huge problem with that on Linux.com or NewsForge, at least not that I'm aware of. I know that when I first put up my weblog, you know, I started seeing tons of it. I run WordPress on my personal weblogs, and luckily I installed what was it, Gizmet,
right,
which is taking care of it.
Yeah, that's that content spam, man. That's crazy stuff.
It's I don't understand the mentality, the spammer mentality myself, but it's you know, again, it's a shame, kind of like the legal situation. It's a shame that there are a small, dedicated number of people who are trying to ruin a really good resource for everybody else, you know, just to make a quick buck.
Speaking of making a buck, how is it that you generate your revenue to keep your people employed off of a couple of websites?
Basically, it's all advertising.
Okay, now, here's the devil's advocate question. Since you're an advertising a website that does advertising to generate money, to generate revenue, do your stories lean in any one particular way as directed by your sponsors?
No. I've never... Since I was employed by Linux.com or by OSTG, I have never been asked to do a story differently or change anything for a sponsor. That's not even a concern. You might notice that Microsoft occasionally buys ads on OSTG sites, and sometimes they even run, they might even run on Linux-related sites.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nobody's ever called up and said, you need to go easy on Microsoft because, you know, they're paying the bills this month. That never happened.
Yeah, I was going to make a comment. Oh, go ahead.
You would know if that had happened because I'd be looking for a new job. I don't. Yeah. I believe very strongly in a separation between between editorial and whatever brings in the income for a publication. You know, it's, obviously, I mean, since we're a pro Linux site, we do tend to have we look for stories that, you know, where Linux is succeeding. I think it would be completely wrong for me to say that we don't have any bias at all. But I think in cases where something is wrong with Linux or open source or, you know, something, we see a problem, we're willing to report it, even if it means it's going to make some people upset.
Mm-hmm. So by having a bias, it's just an editorial bias. It's not a bias that's directed by your corporate sponsorship or your paycheck kind of thing.
Right.
Because you know that there are people that are going to say that, right? No matter what you do, if you're an ad driven if you have ad driven revenue, everybody automatically assumes that the people who will, you know, of course, foot the bill, direct your content as well.
Well, and I mean, I used to do a blog for ZDNet, and not just on the same blog, but actually on the same post, I've been accused of being a Microsoft shill and a Linux zealot in the same post. Two different commenters.
Got to throw Apple in there, too.
So, you know, and people, there's all sorts of people out there with all sorts of interesting ideas, and the nice thing and the bad thing about the Internet is it gives them the power to reach out and communicate those ideas with you.
Yeah.
So, and sometimes they're really interesting, and sometimes they're really interesting, you know? Yep.
They can reach out and touch you with their pointy little tinfoil hat.
What I've been concerned about is, as you know, been over there on Linux.com and looking through this, I'm not seeing enough Get the Facts ads.
I know, seriously.
And I'm concerned about that because I really want to get the facts. And
because, you know, Windows servers are up a lot more than Linux servers are.
Oh, boy.
Did you see that one, man? What a joke.
It's kind of hard to stay on top of debunking all that, too. I mean, just... I think if it comes out with the word Yankee Group on the top of it, you probably ought to discard it immediately anyway.
No.
That's just mine.
So, now, do you guys pay benchmark testing or Yankee type groups to do, you know, reviews. Not reviews, but what am I looking for? What's that? What does the Yankee group do? They
studies. You mean,
do you guys have to pay people to do studies for you to promote Linux?
No. No, we actually, what we get a lot of is when Gartner or somebody has a study they want to promote, they'll send us press releases and try to get us to cover the study and, you know, report the results because they want to get more people interested in buying the hideously expensive, you know, reports from them.
Have you ever told somebody like that that they're full of crap when they send you their press release? You know, one of those, like, I'm not going to publish this thing kind of emails?
Well, generally, the way it works is I get about 60 press releases a day between different sources, so I don't even bother to respond most of the time if it's not of interest. What's really fun is when you get the follow-up phone call. I sent you an email 20 minutes ago. Did you get it? You know, well, I was on the air writing an article, but I'll stop to take your phone call to say I'm not interested in, you know, the fact that Linux is being used in your sweatshop to make, you know, dolls or something. We've never paid anybody like Gardner to do reports for us. If we do studies and whatnot, we, you know, do them in the editorial folks, and we have a small staff, so it's not like we have a huge not like we do any of the huge lab comparisons that some of the other sites do. But, yeah, we wouldn't really be, even if we had the budget and we wouldn't really have the interest in paying Gardner or somebody to do a study for us.
So now, are you yourself, you had mentioned that you really want to see people moving over to a free platform. Are you yourself a Linux user?
That's a good question, absolutely. Basically, I'll give you the really condensed Reader's Digest version. I moved out where I live now. I live in Denver, Colorado, for a job with Linux Mall in 1999. And at the time, I was using Linux and Windows kind of back and forth. When I took the job out here, I decided that I should eat my own dog food, basically. If I was going to work for a company that sold Linux products full-time, that I should use it. So I've been using Linux exclusively on the desktop since 1999, around March.
And now has that
and
also...
Let me tell you...
Oh, no, go ahead. Finish what you were saying.
Oh, just let me tell you, you know, if you think that it's a rough experience at all now installing Linux, you should try it. Blackware on laptop in 1999.
Oh, yeah.
We're with you, man. We're with you.
I was there.
But it's those little hills that really make you appreciate what people have coming to Linux today.
Certainly.
Get to experience.
Yeah.
So you've been for several years now, you have been using Linux as your only or primary desktop, and yet you still manage to actually get tasks accomplished throughout the day on your computer. Is that true?
Oh, I can't get anything accomplished working on a Windows desk. It's the other way around.
Aha.
I worked for a hosting company for a while, and I had to use Windows at work, and it drove me absolutely batty.
Ah.
You know.
Because, of course, you know, we are all still familiar with all the posts and the emails that keep telling us that, you know, you can't possibly get any work accomplished on a Linux desktop, and that... you know, they're still waiting for the desktop, quote unquote, to arrive, you know, for Linux. But I myself have been using Linux desktop as my only desktop for many, many years, too. But it's nice to
basically
hear other people that did the same thing.
What I usually tell people when they say something like that is, look, if all you expect is basically a version of Windows that is... you know, version of Linux is basically Windows, but not from Microsoft, then, yeah, you're going to be disappointed. If you're willing to learn a little bit, you know, you will eventually find that Linux is a heck of a lot more productive than Windows. My little brother had a great experience a couple months ago. He bought himself a, he bought an old laptop of mine, that I had Linux running on and decided, well, I might install Windows on here so I can play World of Warcraft. And then he found out all the stuff he would have to do to install the drivers and everything else to install Windows XP on it and said, screw it, I'm sticking with Ubuntu.
So then you're using Ubuntu as your primary Linux right now?
Yeah, I've been on Ubuntu since the Warty Warthog release. The first release just kind of blew me away. It's actually a friendly version of Debian, basically, and I've been wanting that since StorMix came out in 2000 and then folded.
I remember StorMix. I have a StorMix CD up there. Wow.
So no more Slackware for you then?
No, but I do. I still maintain my subscription for Slackware because Pat is a really nice guy. And if it weren't for Patrick Volkerding, I probably wouldn't be writing about Linux for a living now, because when I first started using it, I sent an email to the support email address for Slackware. This was in 1997, I think it was, and just asking, okay, how do I get X to work? And I got an email from Patrick saying, do this, do this, do this. He was very polite and very nice about it, and it worked, and... you know, if he had been less polite or, you know, like some of the responses you might see on certain mailing lists, I might have just said, you know what, the heck with this. But, you know, he was kind enough. I'm sure he's a very busy guy and was kind enough to reply directly and say, this is what you do. So as long as there's a Slackware, I will maintain my subscription to it.
Yeah, it's a great distribution. I think all of us still run Slackware on a handful of machines over here. Except maybe, Pat. I'm not sure if Pat.
I'm not running Slackware right now.
He's a commie.
I like
bastard.
Pinko. I like Slackware.
Commie pinko bastard. If it wasn't for Slackware. Patrick Volkerding, the world would be a worse place.
I'd like to talk to him, but you know, he's very busy. Plus, he just had a... His wife just had a baby recently, so he's probably a little busy.
He doesn't do interviews.
He's not going to want to talk to you now that you don't have it running.
Yeah, you don't even run Slackware. What the hell do you want to talk to you for?
Turncoat.
All right, so GNOME or KDE? Don't lie and we'll find out.
He's
using the last 6 months or so.
Black
Rock. The last 6 months or so, I've been using KDE. Before that, I was using XFCE most of the time.
Ah, good stuff.
Now I'm using both.
At the same time?
I actually have a desktop set up where, you know what, are you familiar with Synergy?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So I use KDE on my main desktop computer, and then I have a laptop on a riser next to it as a second, kind of as a second monitor, but it's running GNOME. So I'm actually using both.
There you go.
Outstanding. I love Synergy. And there's another one that I use that's a lot like that. And it works pretty well, too, and that's X2VNC. If for some reason you can't get Synergy just right, X2VNC will work well also.
Yeah.
Can't, like, cut and paste.
I think I've got an article on Synergy coming out in the next day or two.
Keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, that's
it better come out in the next day or two now, or I will send you hate mail.
We'll send you a technically correct hate mail.
Do you have your family running Linux, too?
Two of my little brothers use Linux. Basically, my dad still kind of uses Windows because my dad is not terribly computer proficient, and... it's taken him long enough to figure out Windows. I don't really want to disrupt anything and try to do tech support over the phone at this point.
All you got to do is give him the Ubuntu, and he won't ever have any more problems.
That's a good theory. I might. The, the next time I go up to visit, my dad's in Wisconsin, so the next time I go visit him, I might try Dapper on him and see how it works.
And you know what? Since you mentioned Dapper, I don't want to, like, usurp your article, which I know is going to be released shortly about Ubuntu Dapper. But I wanted to know your impressions of the and Dan was getting to this too a little bit earlier, but his impressions about the install of Ubuntu Dapper as opposed to, like, you know, other Linux installs that you've done or Windows installs.
Dapper is just, if you use a live CD installer, it is ridiculously easy. I mean, the only thing you really need to know, unless, you know, something seriously not compliant with your computer, the only thing you really need to know is your name, your time zone, what your password's going to be, and how to the partitioning is the trickiest part. And if you have a whole disk that you can give it, that's dead easy.
Right.
So it's really, really simple.
Not that you've done a lot of these in the past, but what do you think, how do you think Dapper the Dapper install compares to your typical Windows install now?
In the past couple of years, I've probably installed Windows XP about 10 times, either in VMware or for friends. And I would say that it's far shorter, it's a far faster install, and it's far, far easier. Particularly, not so much the walkthrough, like when you do the Windows installer, none of that is particularly hard. But then when you get Windows installed and you have to deal with installing all of the drivers, especially if you're trying to install XP on a machine with older hardware that may not be well supported, or if you're trying to install XP on a new machine with a video card it doesn't recognize or something. I mean, there are a lot of scenarios. Most people use Windows because it's what comes on their computer. You know, I still stand by the idea that if you could just buy a Dell system with Ubuntu loaded on it, that people would be much more likely to run Linux.
I think you're right. And yeah. I think anybody that's had to do a Windows install lately would agree with you that Ubuntu is easier to install.
The worst part of Windows installs is the constant rebooting and patching.
You know what surprised
now,
me? I'm sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you want a challenge, go for OpenBSD. You know?
Yeah, I agree with you there.
But that's like a fun challenge. That's not
it's not an annoying challenge.
No, it's not hard to install at all once you get past the damn partitioner.
What I was going to say is what I found interesting is, you know, with the whole thing about your dad and getting him to use Linux or concern about him using Linux, I have the same issue with my dad, and I have set him up with an Ubuntu. You know, a couple Linux systems. The last one's Ubuntu, and it runs great. It does everything he absolutely wants to do. It very rarely, you know, goes down except for when the power goes out, or if there was, you know, the past. There's been some hardware issues that you just replace the hard drive or put the hard drive in another system. It works great, but he's still insistent on running Windows, and you know, he has nothing but problems, spyware. All sorts of issues, and most recently, he has three systems. He decided to reinstall Windows on one of his systems, and it was Windows 2000. He couldn't get the network card to work because it was a simple N100 card, but Windows didn't come with the drivers for it. And I was floored that it is such an old card that you know, I expect that in 98, but not in Windows 2000. Because I mean, he's had these cards for a good 4 or 5 years now, at least, and the Linksys N100 cards have been around forever.
It's time to buy a new system, Dan. That's the whole mentality.
It just blows me away that it always blows me.
You
gotta
away. You got to go spend $2,000 for a new computer now that your network card doesn't work.
If he said he said a network card for 4 years, he should have the driver's disk too, then, right?
Oh, yeah.
Just like everybody else on Windows that keep their driver's disk,
you
can reinstall
itself,
so easily.
The N100 card is really old.
Yes.
Really old. I just could not believe that it wasn't supported.
Here's what hardware manufacturers need to wrap their minds around. It would reduce their costs significantly if they would just open source their drivers and let the community do a lot of the work, which they would gladly do. They're already doing the work, just trying to, you know, maintain drivers without the proper documentation and without the proper, you know, code. If they just cooperate a little bit, they could save themselves a lot of money developing drivers for Linux and other open source systems.
Certainly, and they most times, like you said, the open source community does a better job. For instance, there's more than a couple times where I ran into flaky network hard drivers on Windows, even with mm-hmm. Even with the company's own binary drivers. They were ran flaky under Windows. I don't know really if you can attribute that to the actual hardware or the drivers themselves or just, Windows crappy TCP stack. But, either way, the card itself works, flawlessly under Linux, and then under Windows it just is kind of crappy. Used to be like that a lot with the wireless cards.
There's also the issue of long-term support. I mean, with Linux, if you have a network card or something like that, the community will more or less maintain that for the lifetime of the hardware. Whereas if you're locked into proprietary drivers, if they've, whipped something up for Windows 2000 and XP, but they don't have any interest in maintaining it for Vista, you're pretty much hosed, because no one can maintain those drivers but the company.
Right.
Go ahead, Pat.
So is Vista going to be a big flop? What do you think?
I'm sorry?
Will Vista be a complete flop?
Will Vista be a flop?
Yeah, he wants to know. That's what Pat says. Will Vista be a flop?
I'm not sure they're ever even going to release it, so I can't. Vista, I don't know that it will be a flop because, let's face it, Microsoft is pretty much a juggernaut. All they have to do is flip the switch, give the OEMs the disk, and people are going to start buying computers with Vista on it, with Vista on them. But I think, if what I suspect will happen, I think Vista is going to cause people to rethink their, trusting their companies basically to Microsoft. Because I don't think Vista is going to be all that when it's released. I think it's going to be a mess.
That brings up an interesting question that I have for you.
Okay.
We have Vista coming down the pike eventually. And this is going to have some serious significant changes in it, particularly to the user interface and then also to the back end. And at the same time, you're looking at Office 2007, which is a totally redesigned user interface. And now the default document format is completely redesigned and not backwards compatible. Do you think that these really large changes are going to start infuriating Microsoft customers? That's one question. And the other question I have is, for the longest time, you've always been hearing companies saying, switching to Linux or switching to OS X or BSD or any other thing or going to OpenOffice is not only just, it's not looking at cost savings with regards to the software and licensing, but now you have an additional training cost. But, you don't have that usually with Office or Windows, but now we have these huge user interface changes coming in these new products. Isn't that going to prove that theory wrong?
I think, the theory has always been wrong. Every version of Office, while not a major drastic interface change, every version of Office probably contains enough changes to be just as different as going from Office to OpenOffice is from going to, say, from Office, 2005 or 2003 to Office XP or whatever. They're usually significant changes. This time in particular, though, with so many changes coming down the pike, I'm hoping that companies will look at that and say, if we're going to have to retrain people either way, why don't we look at retraining them on something that's cheaper? But you know what we really, what I think the Linux community really needs is a serious co-op advertising fund. I think the biggest hinder, you know, one of the things that hinders OpenOffice significantly is they have no advertising budget. You know, they don't have any way to reach out and tell people about it. You have to really look to find out about OpenOffice.
And you know what? That's true with just Linux in general, and because it's you know, being in the Linux community and being enmeshed into it, it provides the illusion that there's a lot more people out there that run Linux or are interested in this than you know there really are. That you know the population of this community is a drop in the bucket compared to the general population of computer users who you know have no clue about a lot of the issues. With regards to the technology and the freedom and everything that we talk about.
Right. That is, and that's one of the reasons, too, I think it's kind of a mistake. You were asking earlier about, you know, is it a bad idea to port things to Windows, you know, because they should run on free operating systems, right? I think that looking at it or framing it in a ethical or moral standpoint is going to be a mistake in a lot of cases because most users aren't even convinced that there is a moral or ethical issue at stake at all. I mean, they don't think of software that way. You have to get people to think of software that way before you can make that argument. And we're certainly nowhere close to that yet.
Right.
So, I mean, the Richard Stallman approach, while I respect Richard Stallman a great deal, isn't going to work with, you know, the average user. They're going to look at that, they're going to hear that, and they're just going to shut off.
Right.
We need a Super Bowl ad is what we need.
We need 20 Mark Shuttleworths.
We need Linux.
I'm sorry?
We need 20 Mark Shuttleworths.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, that would be great. Mark Shuttleworth is probably one of the best things to happen to Linux in the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah, definitely. What we need is Linux.com to start producing Linux commercials in the Theora format and then using their advertising money that they generate to get them on the Super Bowl next year. Yeah. Right?
See, I wonder, do we generate enough money to buy a Super Bowl ad?
2 seconds.
Those things are expensive.
You know, you might be able to generate enough money to put an ad on
the Tech Show.
a Star Trek Enterprise rerun on UPN at 2
maybe
o'clock in the
maybe
morning.
Maybe a Star Trek convention.
There you go.
Well, now, I haven't watched television in a couple of years, but I seem to recall that IBM used to run ads during Enterprise.
Yeah, they did. They had a handful of Linux ads that they ran. And
they had the creepy one with the little blonde kid.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really understood what the little, you know. Of course, you know, I understood what it meant, but the general user, I don't think, really understood what that actually meant and what it meant for them.
It's a whole mystical experience. What they really need is like a rat pack of executives sitting down for their 4-martini lunch talking about how much better their stuff runs under Linux than Windows, how much more money they save, you know? At least that's my opinion.
I think what we could really benefit from is what Apple has had for many years, and that's product placement in television shows. You ever notice, like, Apple is maybe 3-4% of the user population, but if you turn on a television show, like, almost inevitably, every computer will be an Apple computer.
Right. You know, I think we brought that up to Dean Haglund.
Yeah, Dean Haglund from the X-Files.
Yeah, and
it's because Steve Jobs goes around giving them away in Hollywood.
Right. Except when a laptop catches on fire.
Away.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, that's the thing. You might see the actual hardware, but you really never see the operating system that's running on top of the hardware. It's always like some...
It's a mock-up, he said. Mock-ups.
You don't... Yeah. You usually just see, like, some kind of application window, like, but you never really see...
You just see a huge orange sign says password or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Or the ever-present bong where it says, I'm sorry, you've moved your mouse. Please reboot.
You don't get that anymore.
You've connected to an alien computer. Would you like to upload a virus and save civilization?
Bad movies.
Well, there's been some movies, you know, that have come out. What was it? Antitrust had the GNOME desktop.
That was a lame movie.
That doesn't matter.
You know what was a good hacker movie, man, that I saw recently again? Sneakers. That was a good movie.
Hackers with Angelina Jolie.
Oh, God, that was bad.
I didn't watch the movie.
Yeah.
You watched it for
Fish
Angelina
lips.
Jolie? Yeah. Fish lips.
But, yeah, we do need to get... It'd be nice to see more Linux in popular media. I was surprised that Dave Chappelle had a Linux reference on one of his
shows.
That's
right, the first season.
The first season of the first... I think it was the first show.
Yeah, the guy goes to Kiko's in the middle of the night?
Yeah. Do you know who we're talking about? You know who Dave Chappelle is.
Dave Chappelle?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, did you ever see his show?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think it's like...
My little brother's a big fan.
Yeah. He had a skit in there where he mentioned Linux, and I was like, wow. Yay! And then he went crazy. And that's, you know, I don't know. But it's good stuff. I mean, Linux.com, good stuff.
Good stuff.
So what kind of wonderful things can we expect to see from Linux.com under your expert tutelage in the near future?
Aside from the Ubuntu review and the Synergy article.
Right.
Basically, you know, we're going to keep concentrating on trying to give articles which kind of, you know, a wide range, stuff that's good for people who work in data centers and stuff that's good for people who have never used Linux before.
You know what I would really be interested to see, actually, is a really intelligent fellow such as yourself that might want to write an article about how wonderful certain Linux podcasts and stuff were. You know, but no, seriously. We maintain a Dan actually maintains a collection of Linux or very close technology related podcasts on his site, thelinuxlink.net. And you never like they never get any real airtime that we actually do have as a community. We have several, you know, podcasts and radio shows and things of that nature that people can actually listen to, as opposed to, as opposed to just trying to grab their news off a /dot as it happens or whatever.
You bring up a fairly good point. There's a lot, you know, you hear a lot about, like, Twit or, you know, similar podcasts like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they miss the Linux news logs.
Sure,
there's
a pretty
Linux
big
reality.
There's a pretty big open source community out there doing that kind of stuff.
Today was a techie, BinRev, stuff like that.
Ready?
I don't know. Do you listen to podcasts?
I'm sorry?
Do you listen to podcasts?
Not a great deal, I have to admit. Basically, I can read a lot faster than I can listen to conversation.
Uh-huh.
So I usually gravitate towards print.
It's hard to pay attention to a podcast and read at the same time.
Yeah. There's just part of the reading part of my brain kind of shuts off the speech center when people are talking, and vice versa.
Right. So has journalism always been your career?
I went to school for English and journalism. And kind of when I graduated, I had just gotten into Linux a little bit, so I really wasn't sure quite where I was going to end up going. I've worked over the past 7 years or so, I've either worked, well, I've been freelancing the entire time, but I've either worked writing full-time or I've been system administration full-time and writing on the side. So kind of a little bit of both.
Cool. Let me ask you about one more topic before we have to close up here. And I'm bringing it up because it was just briefly mentioned on the chat that we run here. Net neutrality. Does the threat against net neutrality concern you, not only as a you know, person involved in the free software and EFF movement, but with regards to Linux.com losing, you know, possibly losing some bandwidth because of you know, threat to net neutrality?
It absolutely concerns me for a lot of reasons. One, I'm not comfortable with any form, with giving anybody permission to censor networks, whether it's for profitary reasons or whether it's, you know, because they disagree with somebody or because they compete with them or whatever. The internet works because basically as long as you have a connection to the internet and free software, you can publish. And so the idea that the powers that be could basically turn off the connection for, you know, let's say a site like Daily Kos or, you know, a liberal site or, you know, a conservative site that people don't agree with, the thought that you could basically shut down the connection to that site for all the people who subscribe to Comcast, for example, that's terrifying. We have enough problems, I think, in the United States with people being able to get unbiased news or a wide range of news as it is. Giving any company or anybody control over what people can see or what you can publish is very scary. And as we've seen with patents and other, you know, legal issues, what's going on with patents and other legal issues as they affect free software, the entrenched players are trying to stifle innovation and maintain their market share by using, you know, not by using competitive tactics, but by using anti-competitive tactics like software patents. If you give them yet another tool to do that via, you know, ending net neutrality, let's say that Microsoft strikes a deal that, yeah, we're going to, you know, it's already in the entertainment industry's interest to shut off BitTorrent, right? So throw Microsoft in there and suddenly small projects that distribute free software via BitTorrent have no way to distribute software. Legally, they can do it, but because of, you know, blocks on those ports or whatever, they can't.
Right. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's a deal.
Yeah, it is a
long.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry.
I was just saying it is a terrible thing to have happen if it does come to fruition.
I hope people understand why it's a big deal, and I do hope that they, you know, pressure their legislators into not allowing it to happen.
My concern.
And by the way.
Go ahead.
Just a quick plug for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I've been a paid-up monthly member for quite a while, and I would encourage anybody who cares about that sort of thing to be as well.
Yeah, definitely, it's a great organization, and you know. But my concern is like the whole Linux issue, and I'm concerned that there's just not enough people out there that realize that that's even a threat, the net neutrality, or that's even an issue.
It's really hard to make people aware of it. Again, it's, you know, look at the people who are in support of net neutrality and then look at the organizations who are against it. It's the well-funded, large organizations that can hire hundreds of lobbyists and, you know, try to push backroom deals versus lots of people who care about it but don't have the resources to fight it.
Right. Not a happy day.
So, no.
But with the power behind the EFF and the free software community and advocacy, we can make these issues known, bring them to light, and, you know, hopefully capture a brighter future for everybody.
That's right.
All through Linux.com.
And the power that's invested in Dan's Funderoos, Superman Funderoos, he can do anything.
Yo, Joe.
Hey, Joe,
I want to thank you for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it. You're doing a great job over there at Linux.com. Keep up the great work. I'm sure those three or four listeners who we have that have never heard of Linux.com will definitely be checking it out, because it is, you know, it's been a very popular site.
Absolutely.
Linux.com and NewsForge. I mean, there's stuff that I look at on a constant basis.
Places that I visit every day, and if anyone out there listening to this doesn't visit them every day, they're missing out.
They should.
They're missing out.
Subscribe to the RSS feeds, everything. Good stuff. I want to thank you.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Thanks a lot, Joe. It was real fun having you on tonight.
And, you know, we're going to – I got to finish up my little quick discussion on this MacBook over here and Linux on it. You're welcome to stay on if you want, or, you know, if you got other things to do, we can say goodbye right now. We appreciate it.
I'm going to go ahead and log off, but again, I really appreciate you guys having me on, and I will be listening in the future.
Thanks, hopefully we can have you come back on in the future, you know, if you're up
for
that.
Definitely.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Take it easy, Joe.
You too. Bye-bye. Talk to you later.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, before we hit that 10:30, I want to finish up what I was saying about this MacBook.
You got 15 minutes. You better cut it out pretty quick, man.
Yeah, okay. Here, so now I'm a little more alive and awake.
Leave out the farting part.
You got to save that picture, by the way.
Yeah, I will pull that picture off and post it on somewhere, right next to the Evil Gen 2 picture. I should put it up on the webcam.
Yeah, put it up on the webcam,
Yeah, but, you know, then I got to... I'll
have internet access. It's a great picture.
No, I have internet access.
Which one?
Do it, man. Do it.
This one.
Everyone's going to crack up.
Oh, yeah.
It's a picture of Alan with, like, this alien head. It's really funny.
During the interview, they were playing with this...
The hot MacBook.
MacBook.
Jesus Christ, that thing's hot.
Man, melt your balls off, man.
I noticed as Dan had me pass it to Alan that I grabbed onto the back of it, and it, like, burnt my fingers. You know,
well, it's not burning, but I wouldn't want to.
Dude, it was hot, man. I smell bacon.
Yes, I don't think you'd want to sit it on your on like if you're wearing shorts.
Yeah,
I don't think you'd want to sit it on your legs for a long period of time.
You know, they had this thing about I don't even know remember where I saw, but they had this thing about, you know,
because even
MacBooks
the
catching on fire and you know the whole thing back a while ago about. People hurting their testicles with their laptops. This is hot, man. It's hot.
Even the desk, when I picked it up, God, the desk was hot over here.
Dude.
It definitely needs, like, little legs on underneath that thing.
It needs to be a little fatter and have some fans in the damn thing, I think is what it needs.
All right, well, anyway, I had left it off that I was having a problem with boot camp and Ubuntu was not.
We gotta get Pat a pop filter too.
Ubuntu was not liking the way that boot camp partitioned. The way that boot camp partitioned the hard drive for some reason, which you know, be it as it may, whatever, I don't know. Anyway, what ended up happening then? What I decided to do was wipe everything out. At that point, and I figured I'm going to have to go down the route of partitioning it myself, like I did with my other systems. So I repartitioned the drive. I left 30 gigs of free space, and I installed OS 10. And then I went immediately into installing Ubuntu after that. And this is the first time I've ever used the Dapper Drake installer, because I just, you know, when I did the upgrade to Dapper Drake.
No, wait just a second here. You... You reinstalled OS 10,
right?
But you left free space at the end of your drive or whatever,
right?
And when you started the Ubuntu install, you just put the CD in and booted from boot camp.
No, I didn't have boot camp on at that. I didn't go to boot camp route at that point. I figured what I would do is I would start the Ubuntu install, and you know, repartition that free space. you 15 gigs, and then I'd... No, actually, I didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't do a 30 gig. I did a 50. My plan was I was going to install OS 10, and I have 15 gig. I made a 15 gig free space partition, mm-hmm. just free space. Right. I was going to install Ubuntu into that 15 gigs, and then I was going to use Bootcamp and split the OS 10 partition and install Windows XP like you're supposed to through Bootcamp.
Right.
Okay, that's where I was. At this point, I had 85 gigs allocated to OS 10, 15 gigs for the Ubuntu. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, are we clear? Can I move on now? Or?
Right, and then you just booted from CD to
I booted from the Ubuntu CD. Right. Not a problem. Came up, and like I said, this is the first time I've ever done a Dapper install this way,
mm-hmm.
because I just upgraded from, you know, I went from Breezy
right.
to, I'm sorry, from what is it? Warty was first?
Warty
to Breezy to... Mm-hmm. to Dapper, and I was really impressed. It was a nice graphical installer. It was pretty easy. I did the custom partition because I didn't want to wipe it out.
Right.
And at that point, you know, and I was surprised how fast it actually went. From the from the start of the installation, and about a half an hour later, I was at the Ubuntu. Well, I would have been at the Ubuntu desktop. Unfortunately, when you're working with a MacBook Pro. Or
you can't
MacBook.
Boot into the...
You can't boot directly into... Right. You need to use the EFT. What is that called? EFT.
EFI?
Well, you need to use, EFI. Well, you need to use some special multi-boot software because it doesn't... the BIOS doesn't pick up wherever you're installing.
See, now that's what I wanted to find out how you did because, you know, I got that Mac Mini sitting at home. But would love that.
Oh, it was really, really easy.
Can't boot
actually,
the
there's a website. And I just do Google Ubuntu MacBook install, and there's a website right over there. It's step-by-step explanation of how to actually do it. Once you get it installed, you're going to have to pull down Lilo because I guess Grub doesn't work that well with it. And you install Lilo, the SMP kernel is another thing that you should bring down and install. And after that, you need to use Parted to... and you also have to have the... Let me tell you what it is. Let me bring up my... There's a program. It's called REFLT. It's when it comes up. You need to install that. And when you boot, it allows you to choose what you want to boot to OS 10 or Linux at that time. It's kind of like a multi-boot thing, so it'll pick up the Lilo, and it'll boot the Ubuntu or OS 10 or whatever it is. And it works pretty good. Again, I should have wrote this stuff down in my notes, but if you just Google that, it's something off of SourceForge. It's I think it's EFLT.sourceforge.net is where you get that. Really simple install. It's just a shell script. And it installs it right into the boot area for the OS 10, and you're good to go. Now, just a few extra steps you have to do in the Dapper Drake install. And I think any other Linux install, you'd have to do it the same way, essentially. But it runs great. It runs super fast, and I was pleased with it. I did the updates, and I was good to go. You know, I had absolutely no problems. It seems like 3D acceleration is working, although I haven't flushed it out that much.
What kind of video card is it, ATI?
Yeah, it's an ATI card. So what I did next was I figured, okay, I got to get XP on here. So I reboot in OS 10 and I run Bootcamp. Well, lo and behold, because I did not read the entire documentation for Bootcamp, I can't use Bootcamp now because I manually partition my drive and the hard drive isn't one single Mac extended file.
And it has to be for Bootcamp.
It has to be one. A journal, Apple HFS Plus file system one, not mm-hmm. just one partition. It will not work in a multi-partitioned hard drive, which I was like, damn, that really sucks. I mean, I'm not going to wipe it out just to install.
Here's a question for you, though. Can you fix your partitioning scheme under Linux or wherever you can do it and get some free space? And then because you said you installed Lilo
right.
for Ubuntu. So why couldn't you install XP on a free partition and then use your Lilo to point to XP to start it up?
I thought about doing that, but I didn't want to wreck this install until, you know, tomorrow.
Until tomorrow.
Yeah, until tomorrow. But what I did is I went down the next step is I pulled down an application called Parallels.
Mm-hmm.
And you've heard of Parallels?
Yeah.
It's a virtual machine.
They have a version that runs on Linux.
Yes, they do. And I pulled down a trial because I only have this laptop for 30 days. I pulled down a 30-day trial of that, and I figured I get XP and Linux because you can run them all side by side.
Sure.
And, of course, I started with XP because I already have Linux on here. And this time I was able to use that multi-disk, that multi-OS disk from the MSDN.
Mm-hmm.
So I installed XP Pro on there. And the first time, you know, it copied the files, it rebooted. I got past the HAL error. Didn't have that thing, but, you know, it came up and it said 39 minutes. It's configuring some stuff, 39 minutes left in the install. It was like that for about 15, 20 minutes. Then I got an error message. So, like I said, you know, I don't have time to mess with this right now. It's time for Ubuntu again. So I fired up, you know, I created a new virtual machine image on here for Ubuntu, popped the Ubuntu disk in. 20 minutes later, I have a functioning Ubuntu desktop mm-hmm. under Parallels, running side by side with OS X. I started installing stuff. I said, you know, I really want to see how video playback would be under Ubuntu, under Parallels, you know, running on OS X. So I pulled down MPlayer, the Win32 codecs. I go over to Apple's QuickTime site. I had the MPlayer plugin for Firefox. Go over to Apple's QuickTime site, and I watch a trailer. I wanted to see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre trailer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I go click on that. And it says, well, we're only showing the trailer between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. So you can't watch it unless you're watching it between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. So I did the Superman trailer, and it worked. I was like, wow, finally, on an Apple machine hardware using Linux, I'm getting QuickTime video support
mm-hmm.
with sound. Sounded great.
With sound.
And yeah. To top it off, I have Flash, too. Cool. I have Flash capability under, you know, the Apple. So I was digging that. I was really loving it. I mean, it's working great. You see it right here, right now. Parallels does a good job.
Well, we see it.
Yeah, we see it. I mean, I got Ubuntu running on here. Unless, what did you do with it?
You had it behind that, your last page. One more back.
Behind here?
Yeah, I think it's behind there.
Oh, yeah, there it is. No, that's not it. What'd you guys do to my Ubuntu? Did you guys minimize it? Oh, there it is.
I have no clue.
See, look at that. There's the OpenGL screensaver.
Nice.
Really ready to go.
Nice. And it looks so nice and smooth on this $3,000 laptop.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things I got to keep in the back of my mind here. It runs great, and it probably runs great because I have 2 gigs of RAM in here. I got ample amounts of RAM. And, you know.
I really should install that and check it out on my you know. Slightly lower spec Intel Mini.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how that works for your system. But I finally went back and did the XP install. I rebooted last night and started up the virtual machine. And for some reason, the install went through. After that, I didn't even have to put the disk back in and restart the install. It went through, and now I have XP, and XP works.
Like XP?
Like XP.
And, you know, it works. It's function. You know, it mm-hmm. works fine. You know, I don't prefer it, but I didn't have any problems using it so far. I mean, I went out there, I installed our antivirus software. I installed the Novell client on there to see how well that would work, and I did the Office install, Office 2000. I couldn't get Office 2003 to install for some reason,
mm-hmm.
but I was doing that off the network. Yeah,
now, the Parallels machine that, excuse me, Parallels is supposed to let these operating systems run in near processor speeds. Is
right.
that what it is? Not like QEMU or whatever.
No, no, it's
233 megahertz.
You know, it runs pretty well. Like I guess it all depends on how much system resources you have on here. Like the RAM I have on here. I mean, it runs pretty speedy. This is the first time I'm ever pulling up the GIMP.
And it's loading your, you know, extensions and stuff right up there.
Yeah,
it's,
so I mean, it's bad. It runs really well. But again, your speed may vary depending on how much RAM you actually have.
Uh huh.
Thank you for the 3 minute count there, Alan. It's a really nice virtual machine.
Well, I think it's nice because all of a sudden BinRev drops off.
Yeah.
You're in the middle of something.
In the middle of a conversation.
It just sort of gives you, you know, a way of ending it nicely.
It is a really nice virtual machine.
You notice that Dan starts talking faster and faster.
Yeah. As it's a lot cheaper than VMware. I mean, it does have...
I don't know. I thought my copy of VMware was really, really
cheap.
Yeah,
well, not all of us got a free copy of VMware. But it's a lot cheaper than VMware.
It's only 50 bucks, right?
Yes, something like that, 50 bucks. And, I mean, aside from like QEMU...
Right now, because it's still in beta, the price is going up, I guarantee it.
Probably will.
I got to try it out with the native Linux version to see how it power everything works with there.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see the native
Linux
version.
Do they really have a native Linux
version? Yeah, they have a native Linux version.
I'm definitely going to try that now.
They give you a 30-day trial, I think. You can try it before you buy.
Yeah, you can try it for 30. This is the 30-day trial. You just give them your email and
definitely do that because I got that.
They'll send you.
Yeah, I got that free version of VMware was a Workstation 5 or whatever. And I really like that.
It's nice,
VMware. It's really nice and... But I really would like to compare and contrast with this, which looks beautiful. That's a Russian
company, right, Dan?
Does Parallels? What it's supposed to do, I don't know. I didn't look too deeply into it. I just used
gentlemen,
it.
This is your 1 minute warning.
Yes. So it's really nice to see at the tone
1 minute.
And I'd be interested to do that. What you said I thought about that, and my concern was. Windows is going to try and overwrite the bootloader.
Right.
And I was wondering how that's going to work or if it's not going to work at all. And it's going to be problematic. Now, the EFCT or EFLT or whatever it is says that it will pick up other Linux or just about any, distribution or any operating system you install on there.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think the limitation is going to be with Windows. More so than it will be with, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I'll probably wipe it out and reinstall everything again. But it's just cool to have Ubuntu on there. I wonder how well Slack would do on there, too.
They have a package for Slack where TSA.
Oh, yeah, I see
a
that.
What?
They have us, Parallels
has
a Slackware.
Parallels has a Slack package.
No, I didn't mean Parallels. I meant installing it natively instead of outside of a virtual machine. Binrev is gone.
Yeah. I shut the Binrev stream off.
Good night, Binrev, even though, you can't hear us anymore.
Yeah. Good night, Binrev, even though they can't hear us.
Oh, well. Yeah, really cool, one glitch I did notice for some reason under Parallels is when I run multiple VM virtual machine sessions, and I suspect this has to do with the DHCP server, I fired up the Windows one today when I got to work first. And it got an IP address, but when I fired up the Ubuntu one at the afterwards, I didn't get an IP address on that. Even though I can manually configure an IP address, it wasn't, and it would work. It wouldn't pull one off natively. But when I ran just the Ubuntu yesterday, I had no problem picking up an IP address.
That's odd.
So I wonder if it's not, it's basing it on hardware. The MAC address or the Ethernet, the MAC address of the device, and maybe it's not generating multiple ones or.
VMware gives you gives you like a different IP address for each virtual session. You can actually do it two different ways. That's one way of doing it.
VMware does its own bridging.
Yeah, it does a bridge.
So you get like an internal, but this.
You can also use a MAC address too. It lets you do it both ways.
Okay, this one I'm getting whatever the DHCP server issues is what I get.
So it's the same IP address.
No, I get a different IP address.
It's a bridge, too.
But, I didn't even look at that. But for some reason, it seemed to only give me an address for the first one I brought up, and it's something I want to look into, but I don't know. But that Dapper Drake is really...
Snappy, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Snappy, isn't it? Of course, and now that everybody's talked the whole damn time, I didn't get to tell you guys anything about the stuff I wanted to tell you about. But that's okay. Because if y'all
we'll
want to know,
next week.
Yeah, and well, if y'all want to know what the hell I was going to say, you can just crawl your ass right over to my weblog and read it there because that's where it's going.
Or Planet TLLTS.
Save it.
Yeah, that's right. It'll end up on Planet TLLTS too.
Save yourself for the right person.
Save yourself for the right person. If you're looking for a mate, Pat is already taken. So all you guys will have to stand in line. Wait for someone else. Anyway, listen, everybody.
Before we jump off, could we do some shout-outs?
Do you want to do some shout-outs?
Yeah, just next week we got the guys from the Fedora Project coming on.
Yeah.
So that should
be
good.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Frapper shout-outs. Let's see. We've got Florian from Dusseldorf, Germany. We've got Greg MC from Saipan, Mariana Islands. We've got that's like in the middle of the Pacific, by the way, the Mariana Islands.
Yeah.
John Jacklich from Reading, PA. Coach Danny from Winter Park, Florida. We've got Big Pook from Ellington, Florida. We've got Gustav Hartvigso from Stormstad, Sweden. We've got Rue Jedi from Burbank, California. We've got John Farisha from Denton, Texas. We've got Norm from Easton, Maryland. We've got Remad from Virginia Beach, Virginia. We've got Andreas Pfeiffer from Milan, Italy. I think that's our first Italian frapper.
Cool.
We've got Michael Labrie from Adrian, Michigan. We've got Bytecode from New England. We've got Jay Colby from Rochester, New Hampshire.
Is that it?
That's it.
All right. That's still, well, is that it? That's a lot of people, you know. There's I've been to a lot of frapper maps lately that don't have that many. You know what I mean?
Thanks to everyone there listening.
That's right. Thank you all you guys that are on there, whether you registered on a frapper map or not, or just listening, or whether you've emailed us or not. Thank you very much. We appreciate, you know, everything that you guys do for us, and you know, keep on listening, and make sure to grab our file next week, or, you know, if at all possible, listen to us live. Jump on the IRC chat. It's a lot more fun that way, I assure you. And once again, folks, that's it. This is the end of episode 143.
Woohoo!
Yeah, it is.
Yep.
You know what?
Yippee.
Good night.
I'm torn about what song to play. I was going to do Soft Rock by Me. Have you listened to that one?
That's a good song.
But I was also thinking about maybe Tom Cruise Crazy. Have you heard that?
Tom Cruise Crazy is awesome. I think you should play that.
I like that one.
Tom Cruise Crazy.
It's funny. It's a great song.
I got to remember where it
Jonathan
is.
Jonathan Colton. He's fantastic. You guys got to, you know, do whatever you can do to support this guy, because he's really good, you know.
Oh, I'm doing a link now.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. I thought I didn't have it on this machine. Okay.
Cool.
This is Jonathan Colton's Tom Cruise Crazy. Tom Cruise Crazy. It's a great song.
You man.
Yeah, definitely. What Link said about...
what Link said?
Jonathan Colton. Go over jonathancolton.com. You know, consider buying the box that he has there.
Right.
Or purchasing some songs. Throw him back some money so he keeps doing this. He's got a thing of the week. This week it's Soft Rock by Me. It's an all right song. I don't like it as much as the other ones.
Tom Cruise Crazy is good, though.
Yeah, but that's Tom Cruise Crazy. So thank you all for listening, and have a good week.
Good night.
Tom Cruise is so in love with Katie. At least all his people tell him so. And while he thinks that she's a very special lady, probably not the way he'd choose to go. But a lifetime of longing looks would cause too much distraction. Good thing that he's not gay anymore. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes, but you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is always getting older. He knows he'll never be that young again. And when Tom Cruise looks back over his shoulder, he sees a thousand younger leading men. And he knows someday he'll have to play an old retarded grandpa while someone younger plays his sexy son.
Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you've had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big, white, shiny smile. You'd buy expensive shoes. But you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Somewhere there's a place for him, 'cause he's not of this world anymore. Somewhere in some secluded castle, poor Tom Cruise sits staring at the wall. And the outside world is always such a hassle. Sometimes he won't go out at all. There are millions who know his name. Everybody loves him. Why is it that he feels so alone? Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile. You'd buy expensive shoes. But you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise.
Shut up. Just shut up.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Mm, yeah, with my tongue brush.
It's over.